On today's episode of Doctors Who Create, our guest is Dr. Lucy McBride. Dr. McBride did her undergrad at Princeton and her medical school training at Harvard. After her residency at Hopkins, she is now a primary care physician in DC. She hosts a podcast called Beyond the Prescription, in which she invites guests to talk about what it means to be healthy beyond just the absence of disease. She writes a newsletter to more than 20,000 readers, writes for publications like The Atlantic, and appears frequently as a commentator on news. Welcome to the pod, Dr. McBride.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled that you invited me.
On your podcast, you bring in guests to talk about health, but not in the boring way of taking a cold shower keeps you healthy, but rather you let your guests, many of whom aren't physicians, share their life stories on how they were challenged to become healthier mentally, physically, and spiritually. So tell me about how you started this podcast. Walk me through how Dr. McBride became Podcaster McBride. And was that a good description of your podcast?
It was a great description of the podcast. I ought to copy and paste that. So let's see, where do I begin? I'll start by saying that I'm someone who has always been interested in the human experience of illness, not just the illness itself, because after all, people are more than just a set of boxes to check in the doctor's offices. We are more than a bag of organs. We are human beings. And my interest has always been in that sort of inseparability between mental and physical health and helping people recognize the relevance of their mental health and their everyday experiences to their health. You know, the brain is the most important organ, if I may. It is where thoughts and feelings are generated. And guess what? Thoughts and feelings drive our behaviors. And our behaviors largely inform our health and our medical outcomes. So it seems quite obvious to me, as someone who sees people every day in the office, that we ought to consider how people think and feel and how those thoughts and feelings drive their behaviors, whether we're talking about behaviors around drinking alcohol, smoking marijuana, getting exercise, eating healthfully. In other words, health is about more than just your cholesterol and your weight, the number on the scale. It is about your everyday experience of moving through the world. It's about agency over your everyday experience. So it's been clear to me since I've been practicing medicine for 22 years that to simply check people's blood tests and, you know, assign them sort of healthy or not healthy was just denying people the opportunity to be healthy sort of from the inside out. And so just like we have cardiovascular health, just like we have gastrointestinal health, we also all have mental health, right? Mental health is not a sort of luxury item that some people have and other people don't have. We all have mental health, right? The question isn't, do you have mental health? The question is, or do you have anxiety? Or do you have moods? Or do you have a relationship with food, alcohol, your spouse, your work, your partner? The question is, where are you on the continuum of those mental health phenomenon that are part of the human condition? And so when you think about health from that angle, you think about health as not just a set of lab tests, and you think about patients as more than just the sum total of their organs, and you think about health more broadly as really a laddering up from self-awareness about the inseparability of your own mental health and physical health to acceptance of the things you can't control and the things you can. And then you impart knowledge and wisdom and then a sense of agency to the patient, then they are better able to be in the driver's seat of their behaviors, whether it's around alcohol or food or what have you, or compliance with their medications, than simply telling people you're healthy, you're not healthy, great to see you at your annual checkup, see you next year. So it's a long way of answering your question, how did I end up podcasting? I ended up podcasting because I wanted to show people and not just tell people beyond the walls of my office what it looks like to talk to people in a more nuanced way about the definition of health, what it means to weave in a conversation about someone's story as an important set of data to bring to the conceptualization of health. And so on the podcast, I interview guests like I've had the Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, on the show to talk about the epidemic of loneliness in our country. Now, loneliness is not something you can measure in a blood test or a scan. Loneliness is a feeling, and it's a feeling that drives behaviors like alcohol overuse, further social isolation. It can drive depression and anxiety, which can cause, myriad physical and emotional symptoms. So to talk about loneliness is to talk about the invisible suffering that comprises a large part of our health, and shining a light on this invisible suffering is what I'm here to do.
And you thought getting that message out, the podcast was the best medium to do.
The podcast is one medium. My real story is that I've been seeing patients, like I said, in my office for 22 years as a primary care doctor. And when the pandemic hit in March 2020, I started writing a newsletter just to my patients and my family members to say, here's what you do. Here's what I'm hearing about COVID. Here's what, the data are showing. And the newsletter caught on, and I have been writing this newsletter now every week for almost 3 years, and it's reaching now 23,000 people a week. And the goal of the newsletter is to dispense actionable, practical information on managing physical and mental health in tandem. Because health is about doing that. It's not just about, checking the boxes and showing up at your doctor's office and getting an A plus and then leaving, or a B minus or a C plus, whatever your health situation may be. Health is about the everyday experience of managing mental and physical health in tandem. So the newsletter is really the main platform and medium. And then the podcast grew out of that.
I see. I've actually been subscribed to your newsletter for a couple of months now, and when I'm in like, yeah, and when I'm in midterm season or just stressed about something, I see my email notification saying, "Are you okay?" by Dr. Lucy Fred. I'm like, "No, I'm not okay. I want to go to sleep."
Well, that's funny you say that because the reason I titled the newsletter "Are You Okay?" is for two reasons. One, no one is really okay, right? Like we're not. It's not a question of are you okay or are you not okay. It's like the answer is more nuanced, right? It's like it depends on what we're optimizing for, right? If you're optimizing for "Am I alive?" Sure, you're okay. But if you're optimizing for quality of life and a sense of control over our kind of everyday existence, then people are often not okay. People are, as you well know, as a student, and on the heels of 3 years of a collective trauma, people are wired and tired and overworked and stressed. And, while I do think a lot of people, including myself, found meaning within the stress of the pandemic, I think it would be a stretch to find somebody in the world who hasn't had some sort of emotional experience during the pandemic that has been hard. And so the goal of my newsletter is to recognize and validate people's normal experience of being human, not to medicalize the normal traumas and sadnesses we all experience, grief, loss, but also to give people a little more understanding about what it means to be, grappling with, say, anxiety that's sort of normal and in proportion to your responsibilities in your life. And what is anxiety that is really something that's interfering with your quality of life? What is anxiety that has crossed the line into being a phenomenon that is impossible to measure and quantify, but no less important in how you experience your everyday health? Is it interfering with your ability to sleep? Is it giving you heart palpitations? Is your anxiety causing you to avoid, procrastinate, have difficulty in relationships? That's when anxiety is beyond just a normal human experience that helps you get your paper turned in on time. It's something that is worth addressing in a broader way, in the doctor's office, with a therapist, with a priest, a rabbi. And basically, just I'm trying to help people acknowledge that these are all on a continuum.
Trying to create those conversations that might not naturally occur in a hospital setting.
Yeah, I
Right.
mean, these are not happening in the hospital for sure. unless you're hospitalized for psychiatric issues, which, as you know, is happening, unfortunately, a lot more lately. But these are not even happening in the primary care doctor's office. Doctors in this current landscape of the American medical system, don't often have time. Like, primary care doctors don't often have time to get through people's medication lists and check their height and their weight and their blood pressure. And if you have a patient who's 80 and is on 15 medications, you don't necessarily have time in a short visit, maybe 5, 10 minutes or 15, to get through all of those important kind of, tasks and kind of like operational questions. Not to mention to ask that person who's 80 about their grief over the loss of their spouse, the social isolation that resulted from them living through a pandemic, the pain they're experiencing and how their pain interrupts their sleep and how their sleeplessness informs their mood. I mean, those pieces of the human condition are hard to measure, therefore they often get ignored in the doctor's office.
Seems like you're almost doing the opposite of what medical school leads you to do, which is like to specialize in one thing and be good at it. Whereas your podcast and your message is focused on a broader definition of health, which goes beyond the lab results and, as you said, beyond the prescription. So tell me more about how you went from an ER physician, correct?
Well, I was an ER physician for 2 years after my, so I trained in internal medicine. So
Okay.
I'm an internal, I worked, I staffed the internal medicine arm of the ER, one arm of the ER at Hopkins for 2 years before going into primary care, which is an internal medicine subspecialty. But yeah, I mean, primary care doctors, I mean, I have to know, I know a lot about, and I treat, it's not mutually exclusive to have a broad understanding of people's health and kind of the human condition and to understand the nuances of the data on type 2 diabetes and hypertension and cardiovascular disease and thyroid disease. And, so it's not that I'm talking to my patients only in this sort of meta-analysis kind of way or metaphysical kind of way. On an everyday basis, I'm, helping people manage, or diagnose breast cancer, thyroid masses, manage their, kidney insufficiency and their diabetes risk. My point is that those things should not be mutually exclusive. In other words, primary care doctors are trained to be experts in, lots of different specialties, including mental health. In other words, like sometimes people will say, well, how is it that you're interested in mental health? Isn't that just for psychiatrists? And I want to say, well, that's like the same question as asking me, don't you send everybody with toe pain to the foot doctor? I'm like, no. I mean, this is, mental health is part of the primary care experience, just like me checking someone's blood pressure and managing their blood pressure. I don't send someone to a cardiologist to manage high blood pressure. I don't send someone to a diabetologist to manage type 2 diabetes. I mean, that's the bread and butter part of primary care medicine. But my argument is that so is talking to people about quality of life and in addition to quantity. So my job isn't just to extend people's life until they're 95. I mean, I can help people not have a heart attack, not end up in a diabetic crisis. I can protect their kidneys. I can have them not have a stroke. I know all the data on, I mean, this is what I'm trained in, right? It's not just this discussion of the whole broad human condition. It's rather, let's talk about the data, evidence-based medicine on how to manage diabetes, hypertension, breast cancer, menopausal symptoms, and menopause osteoporosis. And let's put that in a context of like, what are your goals for your life? What are we shooting for? Because I can help you live to your 95, but if you're depressed, anxious, and walking around without a consciousness of how relevant your mental health is to your everyday health and how you show up in the world, then that's not really an ideal thing to live to your 95. I'm not saying let's shorten your life. I'm saying let's optimize your everyday life.
So you have to specialize in everything, basically.
In primary care medicine, you have to know a whole lot of things. I mean, but the problem is in the modern American medical system, primary care is often distilled or reduced to just a referral mill. Like toe pain, see the toe doctor. Foot pain, or head pain, see the head doctor. You're crying in my office, see the psychiatrist. Your chest hurts, see the chest doctor. That's not why anyone went into medical school. I didn't train to be a doctor at Harvard Medical School and spend, weekends and libraries for like, my entire adolescence and 20s to then just hand out referrals and say, and rubber stamp people and say, good luck. It's really to understand the human condition and to dig deep into the medical data. I mean, we have to keep up to date with our with the medical evidence, of course, to be able to understand what we're doing.
What I love about your podcast is the diversity of guests you bring onto it. You really include people working in a lot of different industries, but one thing in common, I think, is that they've achieved so much. And the reason I bring this up is because a lot of times it seems like part of their personal or health battles come from being overworked. And studying at Penn, I have a lot of Wharton business friends who work in investment banking over summer, and they're working like 70, 80 hours a week, which is crazy to me. Meanwhile, I'm struggling to work like 40 hours a week. So I think that has to impact your health in some way in the future more seriously than just a burnout. So what do you say to those who are too busy to take care of themselves and think self-care and mental health as like a luxury they can't afford in their career path?
By the way, you're asking really, really good questions.
Thank you.
Yes, I argue that I would argue, I do argue that taking 10 minutes in the patient's annual checkup to discuss how they manage the everyday stress of being human and then the particular stresses of their lives, whether it's caring for an elderly loved one or parenting children or managing a busy job or just dealing with the flood of emails you get every day in your inbox. Spending 10 minutes to discuss like the arsenal of tools you may have to manage that stress and to grow the kit of tools that you have to manage every day stress is a more valuable 10 minutes than me lecturing someone, for example, on cutting back on alcohol and why you shouldn't be drinking so much and why you need exercise. People know in general that exercise is good for you. They know broccoli is a better food item than French fries. They know generally that alcohol, drinking too much isn't good for you. And I don't not discuss those phenomena. In fact, I do. But the question isn't, how much are you drinking? And, here's a number, above which you should not go. The question is the alcohol you're drinking, or is the sleeplessness you're experiencing a direct product of the amount of stress you have in your life? And then how could we kind of connect the dots between your sort of stress and the way you kind of either schedule your day or prioritize sleep or batch your emails to then, offset some of the bodily and like the physical and emotional harms of stress. So, in other words, like that's a conversation that's more meaningful than sort of telling someone like, you really got to exercise more. I mean, my job isn't to like lecture people. It's not also to be a moral authority. It's rather to give people kind of agency, as I said in the beginning. And like I could tell people all day long, you seem really stressed. You need to meditate. You need to exercise 5 days a week. You need to get in bed at 10 o'clock at night, and you need to turn off your phone. Fine. The problem isn't really lack of knowledge on most people's part. I mean, some people have never thought about exercise as a way to help with stress. Fine. Maybe that person is like, oh, I've never thought that exercise is a stress reducer. Okay. But most people know those things. The question isn't, do they know? It's the question of the execution. How are we going to get from intention to how do you get to point B, the execution? And some of that, in my experience, and actually, I would argue that most of that is simply about a conversation with somebody who has a bit of expertise on the human condition, and some of it is a conversation with yourself. For example, I have a son who's in college. He's a 21-year-old kid. He's a thinker like I am. He's for better or for worse. He's like, he's someone who like is very self-aware and like knows himself, but also tends to spend a lot of time in his own head, like I do. So we talk a lot about, and he's a musician, and he's super bright, and I love him to death. We also talk about, which is the fun part for me of parenting, is how to externalize some of the noise so that it's not keeping you up at night, not causing you to worry too much about your future when you can't map out every day of your life when you're 21, and rather to disarm thoughts by putting them on paper, like journaling. Because when you put thoughts on paper, they're a lot less scary. They also don't live in your head as much. And then, working on sort of mindfulness techniques to help kind of bring yourself out of that state of mind where you're really reacting to the thoughts, where you're literally like, you're in the back seat of the car and the thoughts ruminating around, or the front seat, and you're driving around like a race car and you're just reacting. Instead, what mindfulness techniques can do, whether that's climbing a mountain or sitting and doing deep breathing on your dorm room floor, is it helps put you back in the driver's seat of your thoughts. It helps downregulate that adrenaline fight or flight hormone axis and upregulate the parasympathetic nervous system, quite literally, so that you are back in control of your thoughts instead of your thoughts controlling you. Now, those are simple techniques that people can wear and bring with them everywhere they go. It's not a fitness tracker, it's not a fancy app, it's not a set of supplements with fancy packaging. These are things that people can hold in their own bodies to help them bring themselves back to the present, to then open up the brain space to better conceptualize how they want to move through life. Now, that's a tall order for a 21-year-old. That's a tall order for anybody in the current landscape of humankind. But it's what we need to be doing in order to be more intentional about living and intentional about being healthy and intentional about, relating to other people, which is really the definition of health.
I'm very much in my own head, just like you and your son, and literally having just a conversation with my roommates before I go to bed and externalizing that those thoughts can be so helpful.
And what's funny is, it's so simple. And I think a lot of people know that they feel better, and it's unconscious, like that you would talk to a friend or talk to your roommate or talk to whatever, write down thoughts to disarm them. But if you can actually be conscious about what that is and then kind of notice the feeling and perhaps the better sleep you get if you do externalize thoughts, and then you lean into that, and then like intentionally find other ways to do that, to grow self-awareness, to recognize the dysfunctional thought pattern you may have, then that is really the ticket to affecting behavioral change. Take, for example, someone who in adolescence, and I think about all the adolescents who have experienced the pandemic, right? Take all the adolescents who are on their screens a lot more than even 3 years ago, who maybe don't have the support structure in their family lives or their social lives to be able to kind of connect, to sort of understand what their interior world is like. Like, you're a teenager and you just kind of are in a reactive state of mind, and you're on screens a lot and you're ingesting a lot of messages from social media. Like, let's say you're a teenage girl or boy, about like body image and what does it mean to be, loved in the world. And you start to attach, this meaning to being thin, or meaning to eating clean, which is a made-up word by the wellness industry, to, the comparison culture that you're looking at. You're looking at your friends socializing with your other friends, and you weren't invited. My point is that, like, when we are passively ingesting a lot of information, as we all do, and let's say you're a teenager and you're vulnerable, like those thoughts that you can kind of import into your brain that can then drive your behavior to say, skip lunch, feel bad about yourself because your jeans don't fit, shame yourself when you don't get invited to the party. I mean, those things can really die hard and live in your body and live in your behavioral landscape, until you're my patient in their 50s. I mean, my patients in their 50s who are struggling with difficult relationships with food, difficult relationships with alcohol, sort of self-medicating, and then their diabetes is flaring because they're self-medicating despair with alcohol, which just jacks up their blood sugar. I mean, the roots of those thoughts and feeling patterns are often in childhood and often in adolescence. And so the more we can access people at their young ages when their brains are plastic and they're just starting to form those kind of connections between how they view themselves in the world and what they're ingesting, like on screens and, sort of just in the narratives and in the world we live in, the more we can really grow people's self-awareness and help them be in control of their, habits and then their behaviors and then their health as adults. So, I mean, it's a long way of saying, like, this is a really, in my opinion, sort of a moral imperative to really arm people with the language, the vocabulary with which to talk about thoughts and feelings, which at the end of the day, they're born up here and, it's time to address those.
You learn about many different stories meeting with your guest, but tell us about your story. If there was an episode on Beyond the Prescription about yourself, what story would you tell from your medical career or something totally unrelated to medicine?
You're asking such good questions, and this is actually part of the book I'm writing. I'm writing a book for Simon and Schuster. It's tentatively called "Are You Okay?" But it may change. It's about what we're talking about, and it's about following. It's going to follow a number of patients through the arc of their process of self-discovery and awareness and agency. Some of which goes well, and some of which does not, because not every patient story is a success story. But the through line is my story. And people look at me like, oh, she went to Princeton and Harvard and Johns Hopkins, and she's this doctor. She probably has had a charmed life and has not had any problems. Well, that is completely incorrect. I mean, I'm incredibly fortunate to have had the educational opportunities I've had. I have come from a very loving family, and I am human as well. I have a long history of perfectionism, people pleasing. That is rooted a lot in some of the narratives I'm talking about from my own childhood, not through anyone's fault, maybe because I mean, I've done a lot of therapy, so I kind of know where these things come from, but it's in part just being the oldest child of siblings, being it's just sort of my personality type. I've struggled with anxiety. I've had experiences of depression, not just like lowercase d depression, but capital D depression, sort of where it's affecting my physical self. I've struggled with relationship with food, using food inappropriately to control uncomfortable thoughts, which at the time I wasn't aware of. When I was at Princeton University, I took myself to the McCosh Health Center, which is the student health center, and it was, retrospectively, looking back on it, it was a cry for help. I was saying, I'm having all these physical symptoms, my heart is racing, my hands are numb, my head hurts. And I knew it was because I was over-exercising and under-eating, not to compete with girls. And appearance-wise, it was simply a primitive reaction to feeling out of control internally. And it was an attempt to control sort of numb, sort of uncomfortable feelings and feel in control. And the people at the health center were like, oh, maybe you have giardia. Maybe you have, a brain tumor. And so I did all these fancy tests, and no one ever asked me, like, are you okay? Like, how are you doing? How are you doing as a student who's pre-med and an achiever and, who struggles with like perfectionism? No one asked me any of those questions. I don't blame Princeton. I don't blame the people I saw, but I am not gonna, I'm gonna help crack that code and help people understand that I mean, yes, I needed to see a neurologist. Yes, I needed to test my stool for giardia, but let's just face it, the common things are common, right? The physical symptoms of anxiety and depression are much more common in a 20-year-old college student than having a brain tumor and giardia within the same day. Do you know what I mean? So my process of self-discovery is having children and being a parent and being in a marriage and having issues with, work-life balance, like all humans do. It's not that. Basically, I'm human too. The diagnosis is human. And had someone handed me the keys to my own kind of internal world and said, hey, maybe you should think about these things in relationship to one another, would have been really helpful. I mean, I started doing therapy when I was in medical school at Harvard. I just took myself to a therapist. And so, like, I could talk your ear off about the whole process of, becoming a 50-year-old woman, but suffice it to say that I too have experienced all of the same phenomena that my patients experience, just on different degrees and on different axes. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've experienced grief, loss, trauma, mood issues, depression, like just the same things that everyone experiences. It's a question of when, wow, when, where, how, and what are your coping skills? And then also, how do you make meaning out of those experiences if you're lucky enough to be able to do that? Like, I'm lucky enough to be able to have such a, I mean, I'm always learning, but I'm lucky enough that like the work I'm doing now is to me part of the making meaning out of what this is all about, and helping other people recognize their mental and physical health and have vocabulary with which to talk about how they feel. And apply that to the concept of health and like what it how that shows up in the doctor's office is to me the most meaningful thing I could be doing. I mean, it's I love it's, that's just there's nothing else but there's nothing better to me.
Besides the podcast, you write a newsletter, which you said where the podcast came from, and you write for publications like The Atlantic, and you appear as a commentator. Don't make me put words in your mouth, but are these ways of connecting with your patients more outside a medical setting? What do you love about these things that you continue to do them?
First of all, I love any opportunity to destigmatize the conversation about mental health is a great opportunity. In other words, I think we have a very primitive understanding about what mental health is. I mean, I think people think it's sort of a luxury item or something that people who have money do in therapy, when again, mental health is a universal phenomenon. I love being able to communicate very basic, fact-based information about the human condition. And I love helping people see themselves in a different way and sort of giving themselves permission to have feelings and thoughts that sometimes are uncomfortable or even dysfunctional, and not to stigmatize or moralize human behavior, but rather to help people feel more in control of their health. First, by just sort of naming and normalizing the human condition. I mean, we all experience these things. And so if we could drop the shame and drop the fear of being known and being seen by our doctors, for example, that would really go a long way.
You're empowering people to have that agency you were talking about and the tools to express how they're feeling. So, I was going to ask before we wrap up if you have any creative endeavors in mind that are coming in the future, but we just learned about your book.
I mean, I have like massive aspirations for other things. I have a team that I'm growing right now. I mean, I'm doing a lot of speaking engagements. I'd love to, in the next couple of years, do more kind of seminars and workshops for people who want more practical, like everyday advice and guidance. You know, I can't practice medicine to people who are not actually patients, but you can certainly educate broader numbers of people on more practical application of what I'm talking about. Because a lot of what we're talking about today is sort of like the context and the philosophy that I have, but then there are everyday sort of practical applications of what I'm talking about, from, you know, what we talked about already, the journaling to, you know, how to find the doctor in your network who might have time to think about you as beyond just your cholesterol level and your blood tests.
This has been a very insightful conversation. Thank you, Dr. McBride. Where can our listeners learn more about you?
You can find me on my website, lucymcbride.com. You can also find me on all my newsletters are also on Substack. So you can subscribe to Substack. It's lucymcbride.substack.com. And you can sign up for my weekly newsletter. It's free. And then I do a Q&A every Friday where listeners and readers write in questions. This week, actually, I'm putting out my Q&A today is four questions. One's about Ozempic and how to contextualize the conversation about Ozempic, this new weight loss drug, when we're thinking about weight as a complex phenomenon. One is about managing caregiver burnout when you're caring for other people and you're running around and running yourself ragged and making yourself sick from caregiving. One is about what questions you might ask yourself when you're looking to decide if your doctor is a good doctor. Like, how do you make that decision? So these are the kinds of questions I get from patients and from listeners, and it's fun to answer the questions in real time every week on Substack. Thank
Thank you so much, Dr. McBride.
you so much for having me.
If you like what you're hearing, don't forget to subscribe, tell a friend, leave a review. We would love to hear from you.
And if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at doctorswhocreate@gmail.com.
Or tweet us at doctorscreate.
Or
check out our website, doctorswhocreate.com, to listen to our podcast episodes and also to check out other articles and profiles of physicians who are creative.
Intro music brought to you by the band Night Float.